Welcome to the Cowboy Chronicles, the Oklahomans, Oklahoma State football podcast presented by Zaxby's, taking chicken to a whole new level of flavor. Visit your local Zaxby's or order online at zaxbys.com. I'm your host, Scott Wright, joined by columnist Jenny Carlson. And Jenny, Texas Tech game is here. We got a special guest on the line, so we'll jump right to it. Deion Amati, former Oklahoma State defensive back. Deion, thank you for joining us, man.
Man, thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking with y'all.
Cool.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump in and get your take on these Cowboys. Let's start in the secondary where you're most familiar. What have you seen from those guys so far through five games?
Man, it's been an interesting transformation because I mean, as we all know, Malcolm Rodriguez, kind of the leader on the back end there, moves down to that linebacker position. So a little bit of a hole was left in the secondary as far as a leader and somebody to count on. But still, you know, we knew what we had as far as on the outside, cornerback being the guys that kind of with the most experience on the defense and guys that we can lean on. We knew the secondary was going to be, you know, the top and bright spot on this defense, and normally you'd like to see it reverse, where your top guys and your leaders are on the front seven or the front six, where you can get a pass rush and your corners and your safeties don't have to cover that long. But this year it's kind of the opposite. You're leaning more towards the secondary to kind of lead the defense with AJ Green and Rodarius Williams. And as you can tell, I mean, last week was a perfect example of that. I mean, Kansas, I mean, Skylar Thompson, although the defensive line did a great job, especially on the run, he did have a lot of time to throw throughout that game, but there was nowhere to go, and there was a couple of coverage sacks because of it. He was frustrated on the sideline, and that's kind of how I'm hoping the rest of the season goes. I mean, this is the Big 12, though. You see a lot of terrific passing offenses and some deep throwing ability, but for right now they're looking good, and I'm happy with the play of especially the safeties. Parker O'Pill and Bernard and Troy Sterling coming on great. Saw him in the paper and getting a lot of shout outs this week for his terrific play and leading the team in tackle. So it's a good back end that we got right now.
Deion, you know, the cornerbacks being such a known commodity, and you know, I think that there are still some really tough passing offenses left on the schedule, obviously, so we'll continue to be talking about those guys. But, you know, that safety position you talk about, we knew that those guys were going to be better this year, but I've been, frankly, even more surprised at their play than I thought. Have they exceeded what you thought they might be able to do as a group, as a unit?
You would have to say yes, right? I mean, yeah. First of all, it was an added benefit that, you know, Bernard and Harvell Till got a lot of playing time, a lot of experience last year as freshmen. I mean, that's how football goes. You're young one year and you're experienced the next. So right. It's great that those guys got a lot of experience. The question mark was, all right, Malcolm's going down. Who is this Trey Sterling kid, and will he be able to play? And I mean, the question at the beginning of the season, and now we're looking five games down the line. This is a guy who, you know, almost built to play this position. He's experienced. You can kind of tell his instincts are really incredible. He reads his keys well. He comes down hard in the run, and he's doing a great job in passing downs as well. So they've really exceeded my expectations, especially when you thought we were losing one of our best tacklers and defenders on that back end.
Deion, looking at the two corners, what have you seen from those? It's tough to tell. It doesn't seem like people are throwing at AJ Green a ton, and Rodarius seems to have been pretty solid in coverage. What have you thought of those two guys this far?
Competence. You can tell it. That I feel like that's the biggest difference between last year and this year. Now, AJ Green, he's always been a confident player, and Rodarius, I would say a little less confident, but this year, both sides, you can see them, they're not wavering. I mean, last year, I mean, Rodarius's brother, Greedy Williams, which is a great name, by the way, and I probably would be a little upset by my parents if they gave my older brother a great name and I get Rodarius, but that's besides the fact. Both of those guys, just confidence is there. You can, I mean, in that Texas game, it was very evident. Like, because we lost and Sanders, you know, jumped onto the scene, you didn't really hear from a lot of people, but the corners had a terrific game. And I know Texas was missing their number one wide receiving threat, Colin Johnson, but they still had, I mean, in my opinion, Eagles was a better deep threat wide receiver. He's the guy with the speed in that Texas wide receiving core, and they did a great job handling him. They did a great job handling Epps, number 85, on the other side, and they really didn't throw down the field that much, especially in the X and the Y position, and it's because those corners were shut down, and you could see it in their eyes. They were confident. They want those big-time guys. They look forward to playing those big-time targets. I mean, I'm sure, like, I don't want to speak for them, but I'm pretty sure they're looking forward to seeing, you know, some CeeDee Lambs and some Denzel Mims coming down the line here in the schedule.
You know, we heard
and
from...
And Basher as well. You can't forget about Texas Tech, Basher, yeah. number 9. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they're looking forward to facing those guys.
You know, you mentioned earlier, Dion, the fact that there hasn't been maybe, and we heard this from Jim Knowles after the game the other night too, not a ton of sort of cutting guys loose to pass rush, and sort of haven't seen much in that regard just yet with this new defensive line. You know, Knowles indicating that that's coming, but I wonder from a secondary standpoint, the position you know so well, can a secondary, can you go without that for a long time, or is that a situation where they're gonna have to, you know, maybe it's not a ton of sacks, but maybe it's hurries and maybe those sorts of things. How does that long term play out for a secondary?
I mean, it gets harder and harder as the season goes along. I mean, you have to have some like NFL guys back there that are like, all right, coach, y'all can just, you know, don't blitz anybody. Don't bring any, y'all don't need to get that much pressure. We can handle everything. I mean, I want to say like 2013, when we had Ashton Lampkin, Patman, Justin Gilbert, Daytuan Lowe, Shamil Gary, I want to say 4 or 5 of those guys played in the NFL. Those are the kind of defenses where you're like, oh, well, we don't have to bring pressure. But, I mean, in everyday defense, Big 12 defense, when a quarterback has time to throw, he's going to pick you apart. If he's going to, it's when he's going to. So I'm sitting there in the first 3 games, I'm thinking, all right, Coach Knowles is not trying to show his hand. He doesn't want to put too much on film. Because, I mean, as you guys know, the first 3 games, that's when the game tape is out. When they have that first, everybody looks at the first 3 and or the last 3 as far as game field and game tape. That's what my high school coach used to call starting fires, because if you do something wrong one game, you're going to have to face it the next 3 weeks to make sure you put out that fire. So I think Jim Knowles was trying to, you know, keep his cards close to his hand and not show his packages, his blitz, because this is a young defense, or excuse me, a young defensive line, young front 7, young front 6. So he was trying to, you know, keep those close to his vest and, you know, unveil them on those big 12 games. So, you know, he had to pull out a little bit during the Tulsa game when we were down there in the first half. But other than that, he hasn't really shown anything. I'm looking forward to him, you know, being able to let loose and let Mike Scott and, you know, the young freshman Trace Ford get after him, because I think we got some guys that can rush the passer.
All right, Dion, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and get a little bit more into the defense and talk a little bit more about your experiences in Lubbock, Texas, which is always an interesting place to visit. We'll be right back on the Cowboy Chronicles presented by Zaxby's. We are back on the Cowboy Chronicles presented by Zaxby's. I'm your host, Scott Wright, joined by columnist Jenny Carlson. And we are joined right now by former Oklahoma State defense back, Dion Amati. Dion, you, before the break, we're talking about the importance of a pass rush. in general, looking at this week, what do you think? Is this an exciting week, you think, for Jim Knowles, because he knows he's got to reach into that bag of tricks and pull out some creative stuff with a Texas Tech team that likes to get rid of the ball quickly?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting because I think you're getting more into those games where you're kind of forced to show who you are as a defense. There's no more, you know, hiding or trying to keep those trick plays in your back pocket. You kind of have to let it all hang loose with the experience of Texas Tech and especially their offensive line. These are some veteran guys, and you saw some veteran experience from K-State last week, and our defensive line held them well. But still, this is a situation where they get the ball out of their hands pretty quickly. They got an experienced offensive line that's played together. You're going to have to throw in some things that they haven't seen before, haven't seen on tape, and it should be interesting to see what Coach Knowles puts on the table.
You know, obviously, Alan Bowman, the Tech quarterback, being hurt, he's one of those guys that, you know, in a league this year with a lot of new faces at quarterback, he was a guy I think a lot of people thought would be, you know, kind of top of the list. But that injury now with Jet Duffy being the guy, how does that change things? Do you feel like it's, I mean, obviously Jet Duffy wasn't the starter for a reason. They thought Bowman was better. How does that change things in the challenge for the defense out at Tech on Saturday?
Well, I mean, you look at Duffy and you can tell, I mean, that's a running quarterback. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has capabilities in the passing game, or else he wouldn't be a Division I quarterback. But still, like, he is a guy that you can count on running the football, you know, at least 10 times a game. So it's difficult because with running quarterbacks, the man defense is always something that you have to worry about. I mean, you can have teams that go against us. Being in man, especially as a defensive back, with your running with your man and your back to the quarterback, is a dangerous situation because you can think, man, I got my guy. He's shut down. I'm good here. And then you have the quarterback running by your left ear hole, and everybody's looking at you like, hey, what are you doing? What are you doing? And you're just like, I'm playing man, sir. So it's always a tricky situation with those guys with some athleticism back there, and that's one thing that this Cowboys defense is going to have to worry about this week.
Yeah, I'm curious, Deion, are you as surprised as the rest of us by the play of the linebackers, and how important we think they'll be this week?
Am I? Wow. Like, Amen and Malcolm Rodriguez, like, okay, I'm telling y'all guys right now, if you don't believe me, I don't care. I called this when I saw Malcolm Rodriguez as a freshman at Oklahoma State. I saw him as a junior at Wagner playing quarterback, and me and him I asked him some questions on the sideline. Literally, I just wanted to know why he was wearing the number 20 as a quarterback. I know it's an old school thing, but I asked him, I was like, hey man, why are you wearing that number? And he's like, it's my dad's number, and so it's a family thing. And so me and him have kind of been close since then. But when I saw him as a freshman, and I was like, wow, he put on some weight. And me knowing Coach Glass and Coach G the way I do, I was like, by the time that guy is a junior, he's going to be a linebacker. Mm. And wow. What do we know? He's a linebacker. And I called it. I don't care if y'all don't believe me. I did it. I know it. I have the football IQ. I do this. But I've been so ecstatic with their performance, and I've been ecstatic with Amen coming down and being the guy that he is now. I mean, the leading tackler on the defense, leading sack guy on the defense as well. These guys, now we have depth in the linebacking court with Kevin Henry coming back from injury, Devin Harper coming back from injury. We got guys that you saw last week. We did a little 3-4 sometimes where we had four linebackers out there, not including the stand-up defensive end. Mm-hmm. So we got some things that Jim Knowles can play with a little bit there, and it should be interesting going down the schedule.
Yeah, I got to admit, Deion, when if you'd have told me before the season that these guys, you know, were going to be the lion's share of the snaps at linebacker, those weren't the names that most of us were talking about. I mean, I think Kevin Henry was out there. Obviously, Calvin Bundage, you know, we expected to see him a lot and haven't seen him at all. You obviously saw something that some of us didn't see, clearly. But I have been really impressed, especially by Ombogbemiga. The stability, but the I think when a guy is dynamic but very capable in every situation, that's so valuable. That guy has been, I don't know if there's been a bigger surprise on the defense to me.
Right? I mean, I'm saying, like, the thing that, like, gets you and that is not talked enough about in football is consistency. Mm-hmm. That's why coaches are afraid of playing young guys, because you just don't know what you're going to get week to week. But when you're a consistent player and you know what you're going to get, you know you're going to put a guy in a spot and he's going to handle it, he's going to take care of it, you don't have to worry about it. For him to be that kind of a player early in this season has helped this defense tremendously. And kudos to him, man, because he's one of those guys that you can – there's two guys in the column. You're like, well, we're going to put him in this situation and and hopefully we get something good. Mm-hmm. But there's that other side of the column where we're going to put him right here and he's going to make plays for us. He's in that spot.
All right, Dion. We'll transition into something else now, because I'm always curious to hear players' experiences in Lubbock, Texas, because there's always, everybody seems to have a some sort of unique story about something. Anything that stood out to you about your trips, or just what was the atmosphere like playing in that place?
Oh man, Scott, I have stories on top of stories. First of all, I want to say this first and foremost. I never lost to a Red Raider in my life.
Oh, there
never
you go.
Lost. Okay, I want y'all to know that right now. The first time I went down there in 2010, I landed. We flew. I landed, and I literally, for the first time, I'm from Texas. I'm from Dallas, Texas, and I've seen all the westerns and how the people depict the cowboy boots and the cowboy hat. The first time I went to Lubbock, Texas, was literally the first time I saw a tumbleweed. And I got off the plane and I literally saw a tumbleweed and I was like, what is this and why is it so quiet and why is there nothing out here? And I called my older brother and I was like, Dexter, there's nothing out here. He was like, yeah, man, I know, because he played at Texas State and I think they played in Lubbock one time against somebody. I was like, Dexter, there's nothing out here. He's like, I know, man. And so we get to the game. We're in the locker room, and you see all the black and the red. And a couple of my high school friends actually went to Texas Tech. Shout out to my man, Zach. He literally just got married, like, last weekend, I think. Couldn't make it to the wedding. Sorry, football season obligation. But so he's out there, and I literally see the kickoff goes, and I see literally 10 or 15 tortillas fly in the air. And I go, what in the world? Those people are about to get kicked out. What are they protesting? What's going on here? And Markel Martin looks over to me and goes, yeah, they do that here. And the referees just like went about their business like nothing happened. I was like, what kind of establishment is this? and like, luckily enough, I mean, it didn't faze Whedon or Kendall Hunter or anything like that. So we went on to beat them that day. So that was all cool. So that was my first experience. Down in Lubbock. So normally in schedules, you know, you play at a stadium one year and then the other opposite year you get to go, they play you at home. But for some strange reason, there was a change in the schedule or something. So we had to play them in Lubbock back to back. So that's the 2011 season. And sadly enough for me, that was the game before Kansas State. I tore my ACL, and I didn't get to play in Lubbock. I was so sad I didn't get to make that trip to Lubbock. You know, I was I wanted to see the tumbleweeds and the tortillas one more time. It was so sad. I was. Shout out to my best friend Devin Hetchpeth. I was in his living room in Derby, Kansas, watching the game. So that was all right. And then finally in 2012, we get to play them in Stillwater. And, you know, that was a rough year for me, but kind of a rough year for the team. We, you know, didn't do too well that year, like the heart of Dallas Bowl. But that game right there, we call that the girlfriend game. and it's a funny story. Isaiah Anderson, probably our fourth or fifth receiver at the time, goes off that game and scores three touchdowns in the first half. Y'all remember that game?
I I remember he had like three catches, three touchdowns. That was it. Was just like they went man on him and he just killed him.
He was ridiculous. Like Isaiah's like Ike. We called him Ike, and he's always been fast. He's always been quick, but he just never really put it together. But for the Red Raiders, he very much put it together that day.
Yeah,
and he scored three consecutive touchdowns. And every one, he either pointed or blew a kiss at his girlfriend.
That's great.
And they got married here recently, so obviously it worked. And then after that, it was the fourth quarter, and we went down there, and my man Zach Craig, who funny enough just got engaged himself. Goes and blocks a punt and returns it for a touchdown.
I remember
and
that.
With the football, he points. And everybody's thinking he's just like randomly doing Zach Craig thing, because Zach Craig, he was an unusual guy. I mean, first of all, Zach was my man. he was funny and corny and so goofy, but he had fun, and he took that football and pointed, and we didn't know what he was pointing at, but the next day at film, we all saw his girlfriend at the end of the end zone, who was a cheerleader at the time, and he was pointing the football at her, and then Coach Gundy was like, Coach Gundy, in the middle of in front of the whole team, Zach, what are you pointing at? And he goes, my girlfriend. Everybody bust out laughing. So 2012, we called that the girlfriend game.
Nice.
Everybody was giving a little shout out to the girlfriend. And then 2013, that go back to Lubbock, and we have a little fun down there. And I feel like that was the most dominating performance by us, not by in the season, but just the fact that that was the game I felt like we figured out who we were and who we could be as a team. I mean, the defense played well. I mean, we had like two interceptions, and we dominated from that standpoint. And then, Clint Shelf, now my broadcast partner, he took on the world by storm by running away from the cop speed, as Gus pronounced it, to the world. and the rest is, I guess, Lubbock history.
You think about all those games that you guys had such success against them. I mean, there was a day and time when Tech was a team that OSU couldn't quite get over the hump. And I think when you were there, Dion, that was kind of when, that stopped being a thing. You guys took care of business, and that's kind of been the way it's gone ever since.
I was going to ask y'all about that. I was literally watching a YouTube clip about like Texas Tech in 2010, because I've taken a lot of hits to the head, so I can't really remember too much about a lot of stuff. But back in 2010, but Coach Gundy was mentioning something about it'd been like 66 years since we had beat Texas Tech in Lubbock or something like that. I was like, is that true?
Well, they wouldn't have played each other for a long time because of different conferences. But and there was, especially early on, you had the Mike Leach era come in, and everybody struggled against the Tech offenses. They were just, they didn't punt, and they, were going for it all the time and shooting for the end zone. But yeah, I think there was definitely that time when Oklahoma State, if there was a hope to get to the level that Oklahoma State has gotten consistently in contending for Big 12 championships, you had to get over the Texas Tech hump. And I think it's, it seems crazy to think now, but yeah, that was a real concern. And I think a lot of it was, how are you going to stop that Tech offense? How are you going to score more points than them? Now, that's not, a lot of offenses have risen to meet them, but I think for a long time, that was a real problem.
And it's funny to think y'all were worried about, trying to get over that 66 game losing streak, and the fans were worried about that. Me, I was just trying to hydrate because I knew that Texas Tech scores a lot of points, and Brandon Whedon and Blackman were going to score a lot of points. So I was going to have to do a lot of kickoffs, and Quinn Sharp was just going to boot it out the back of the end zone, and I just had to make sure I was hydrated enough to run down the field consecutive times in a row.
Oh, man. Good stuff, Dion. Listen, we really appreciate you taking some time to share some wisdom and some entertainment with us, man.
Man, thanks for having me, and we can do this anytime, guys.
Thanks, Deion.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back on the Cowboy Chronicles presented by Zaxby's. We are back on the Cowboy Chronicles presented by Zaxby's, and it is mailbag time. This mailbag is dedicated to Adam in Tulsa. Last week, Jacob and I came on here. We always get great participation on the mailbag.
You do, yeah.
But we had never had anyone email. We always say
the Twitter.
Twitter, email me. Nobody had ever emailed. It had always been on Twitter. So we asked for somebody to email. Adam in Tulsa comes through with five questions.
Adam,
all over it, and he's got some interesting. It's a good range of questions, a lot of variety in his topics. So I'm excited to get into this.
Let's do it.
So we're gonna jump in. Adam, we appreciate it. Anybody else that wants to get in next week, you can still reach out on Twitter. We're not blocking the Twitter questions at Scott Wright. Okay, at Jacob Unruh on Twitter. SWright@Oklahoman.com, JUnruh@Oklahoman.com. Jump into the mailbag. We love whoever participates, but special week for Adam because he actually emailed us some questions.
Next up, by mail, snail mail. You'll be getting questions in an actual mailbag.
There we go. Number one, interesting question right off the top. How candid are you as journalists permitted to be with the coaching staff and players in locker room / pre- and post-game interviews and practice interviews, et cetera? It would be helpful to know what limits you all are permitted to press on questions. For the most part, I've never really felt, with one glaring exception, I've never really felt any pressure restriction to hold back on anything. There are times when you can sense that. Certain questions aren't going to produce an answer from Gundy in particular. You can read his his emotions at times, and particularly things that he's not going to talk about. He's not going to talk about injuries and those sorts of things. But I've never felt like I said with the one exception any issue that I couldn't ask a question. Now I'll say this. In the media, we don't always ask questions the way that fans would probably like us to ask questions.
Yeah.
It's just a different approach that we have to take.
Yeah, I think I think that's probably true because I think fans, there are definitely some instances where there's an accusatory
right.
nature, like. Yeah. Why would you do that? You know, not actually looking for the why of it, but sort of you're an idiot,
or,
you know, those sorts of things. And obviously there are times when, why did you run that fake punt? What is that about?
Yeah.
So obviously, but at the same time, we are in the information gathering job. We want to know the why. You know, mm-hmm. what was the thinking? You know, what was the call? What was the expectation? So I think the difference between a neutral question of why that punt fake call in that instance as opposed to why are you such an idiot and running that. I think that's probably a difference that you'll see in the way questions get asked.
Yeah.
Because we got to come back and talk to these folks again.
Exactly. And I think back to the Texas game. Like people kept wondering, why aren't they running the quarterback sneak in short, third and inches? Or why aren't they throwing in the red zone?
Mm-hmm.
You can't necessarily ask, why didn't you sneak the ball there?
Yeah.
Or you have to ask a question in a different way to get a response that's going to fulfill provide a lot more information.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's the biggest difference in how fans maybe view what we do and how we do when we're sitting in our situation.
Yeah.
Number two. Gundy has historically shown his preference to, quote, stay in it until the end and hope for a chance to win, unquote, mentality in lieu of an approach of open it up and see what happens. What can you attribute this to? Other schools in the conference, OU specifically, seem to play more aggressively and it pays off. It is tough to watch his conservatism, knowing we have grown the program to have better athletes than other schools. I think Gundy gets a little bit of a bad rap as being too conservative.
Probably from Bedlam as much as anything.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
That becomes a big thing. Because, I think about, you know, like if you go to, you know, the last year of Rudolph Washington, that group, they stepped on some people.
And
didn't let him get away. And, you know, obviously there are games where you might have thought that was how the game was going to play out. But there are some other good teams in the Big 12 that year. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, a close shave at Iowa State, like, that really wasn't expected. But I don't think that was because Oklahoma State didn't want to win by 40. It's just Iowa State had a defense that was pretty darn good.
Yeah.
So, you know, you think about teams that when they've had teams that have been, you know, that much better, I think you've seen that. But, you know, last year was more of a year where they were going to be in tight fits. And this year, still yet to be determined, you know, how, you know, could they dominate some teams and those sorts of things. I think this may be a year where it's just a little bit more of a, you're going to have to win closer games as opposed to winning by 40.
Yeah. And now the one area where I'll contradict what I just said about Gundy and his conservatism is end of half situations.
Yeah.
He does seem to really button things down and want to just get out of the half rather than take some chances when I think there are opportunities to take chances. That's the main area where I see some stuff. And you can maybe look at some of the red zone stuff against Texas where they were running the ball all the time, and you maybe see some things that he thought were going to work. He and Gleason thought were going to work and that didn't. But in broader terms, I don't think he's as conservative as fans get fired up about him being.
Yeah, I think sometimes the times that I get most, and it may be that they're, if I thought about it, maybe it would fall in that end of half area. But sometimes when there's a lead built, I do feel like there's a mode where you're taking a little more clock, maybe running instead of passing. And that may be seen as conservative, but it may also be seen as the defense needs a break, or we need to shorten this game by running the ball. Mm-hmm. You know, so it could be a couple thought processes there where maybe you could quick strike it again and score another touchdown really fast, but is there some benefit in maybe slowing it down?
Yeah.
And maybe you only kick a field goal in that instance instead of getting a touchdown because you've gone a little bit of a slower, methodical. I don't know. That could be. But I do know there are times when you start to sense, okay, they've got a lead, and now they've sort of gone into a mode that isn't what's been super successful. I know that there are other benefits to maybe slowing it down a little bit, but those are times I think, you know, you don't want to three and out yourself. You don't want to quick possession yourself when you're trying to give your defense a break, just because you've gone into plays that, you know, maybe are a little bit more, pedestrian.
Right. Number three, at the time of this email, and to be fair to both Adam and everyone, this was before the Kansas State game, before we knew that Tevin Jenkins and Dylan Galloway were both injured.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of this email, OSU has only played four games with Coach Dickey as the offensive line coach. I'm not an X's and O's guy, but have you seen an improved trend with him at the helm, and how do you see the end of the season playing out? I think Saturday was kind of Charlie Dickey's shining moment so far in the season.
Agree.
To shuffle the line the way that he did and have so much success. You know, it felt, but prior to that, it was hard to tell because they had sort of been matched up pretty well against Texas, and Texas has a tough front and some good linebackers, and that wasn't a great game for the offensive line, but they'd had some good games before that. They were dominant at Oregon State. They'd had their moments. Kansas State, though, was the game that they really broke through and showed that this guy has been coaching these guys up because Bryce Bray moves from right guard to left tackle.
Yeah.
And you got Hunter Anthony comes in. I don't know that I would have even thought of taking my who I consider the best offensive lineman at the time without when you take Tevin Jenkins off the field, your center away from center. Yeah. I don't know that I would even consider that.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I thought the Texas game was Texas is going to make plays because they've got good defensive front guys. So, but I thought that there was less dominance by the OSU offensive line in that game than I thought they'd have. I thought there'd be, you know, when you talk about the reason we saw 37 rushing attempts by Chuba Hubbard is because Texas defense was dedicating more guys back than to the box. And so in that instance, you definitely think, well, gosh, they've got to be able to get some of those just creases and seams that right. Chuba can get through in a heartbeat. And it didn't happen as consistently as you thought. And then to see the injuries happen, you start to think, oh, gosh, you know, pregame of that K-State game, it's like, oh, this could be really bad. And instead, yeah, I think that was probably their best game of the year. And that's impressive.
And going forward from here, we'll see what happens. Dylan Galloway, I think he's going to be out for a little while. We'll see. There hasn't been anything official come out on that, but looks like it's a longer-term injury. Tevin Jenkins, I think, could be back pretty soon. I don't know if he'll make it back this week. Might be with the way things went last week, it might be a good week to go ahead and run Hunter Anthony out there.
Yep.
Give him an extra week, then you've got the bye, and have him healthy for the second half of the season. So, fourth question is a good one. I don't know how great an answer that we're going to have. It's an interesting question. But he says, other schools have kept their ticket prices at a reasonable level across multiple sports, but OSU seems to have very high individual game and season ticket prices. What is the basis for this? I don't know a ton about other schools to speak comparatively. I know a little bit about OU. I also know that OSU does vary with football tickets from game to game and section to section. Mm-hmm. Certain sections they have a higher price, whereas OU, as far as I know, every ticket itself has the same face value on it, even though that person that bought the season ticket for that seat might have paid an extra $1,000 or however much additional.
The rights to buy the seat.
Yeah, exactly. In like donor's fees or whatever it is. So, I think OSU has some different strategy in how they price their tickets. I don't know enough about what Texas Tech or Texas or those places do to give a really good answer. I think OSU is pretty reasonable for the most part across the board in what people can get in to see a game for.
Well, and I know that I know when they decided to do the if you want to be able to buy Bedlam tickets or whatever, that strategy was was an interesting one. Some people loved it, some people hated it. And I think they've looked for ways to maybe do some different things with their pricing.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not 100% positive, but they have sort of always been adjusting and maybe searching for ways to drive people to come to games and buy the tickets. And if they can't come, maybe they can get somebody else to come. So I think that's long been a push that they've been trying to figure out, what gets the most people into the stadium. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, it may not be popular with everyone, but that's always been their goal, is to try to maximize the number of people through the gate on a game day.
And two sellouts to this point, so you got to give them credit there.
Yep.
All right, final question and a fascinating one. Number five, do you see OSU ever becoming a blue blood under Mike Gundy, or will it take an heir apparent to take OSU to the next level?
Mm. Well, I mean, to me, blue blood is a traditional thing that is developed over a really long time. Now, I know what I think the question is, sort of that uber elite level.
Right.
Maybe it's a different term in my head, but it's societal. It's not, this is not accusatory. It's just the way it is. Championships are the dominant factor when people think about, who is the upper echelon. So championships on the national level, championships on the conference level. Right now, OU's got a stranglehold on Big 12 championships.
Yeah.
And that really keeps everybody else in the conference, out of the current conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, even Texas with its brand name, I think has seen a step back because they can't even win a conference championship. Right. So until you break that stranglehold, you meaning somebody in the conference, and start to, you know, not just win one, but win two out of three, or, you know, two out of four, get some level of control back at the top. I don't think anybody in the Big 12 besides OU holds that super elite spot at this point.
Right. And sort of to your point about blue blood versus the elite level, mm-hmm. And tell me if you disagree, but I don't consider Clemson a blue blood program.
No, I don't either.
But they're dominant right now, and they're a fantastic program right now. Mm-hmm. I think Oklahoma State can build close to that level, and then it comes down to those moments of, do you get over the hump in Bedlam? Do you give yourself a chance to win on a more regular basis, mm-hmm. and do those things? So that's the question. I don't know if Gundy can get over the Bedlam hump at this point. It's been his probably his lasting last fight. Yeah. The last big hill for him.
But they've done so much other. I mean, this game at Tech, as we were mm-hmm. talking to Dion, a segment ago, this used to be a thing.
Yeah.
And now that seems like a million years ago Oklahoma State had a problem with Texas Tech. You know, that's just not the case anymore. Now, they may lose to Texas Tech on occasion,
right.
But they don't have a Texas Tech problem.
Right.
And so it doesn't, yes, it took a lot of work to get to that point, but it's possible. So in the same way, you know, yeah, it's going to take a lot of work to get over the OU hump, but it's possible. It's just it doesn't happen in 1 year, and it doesn't probably even happen in two. You got to do it on a repeated basis. And right now, as it relates to OU, they're still sort of at neutral, in getting there, because they've just, after success in the Whedon era and that group, they've really kind of, you know, not been able to manage those wins. And you got to not just be competitive, but you got to win in that one.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Adam in Tulsa, thank you for all the great questions. Fantastic mailbag segment.
Way to go,
the rest
Adam.
Of you, the rest of you can jump on in next week, and we'll address all your questions during the bye week, which should be a fun one. Thank you, Jenny, for filling in for Jacob with this week on the Cowboy Chronicles, and thank you for listening to the Cowboy Chronicles presented by Zaxby's, taking chicken to a whole new level of flavor. Stop by your neighborhood Zaxby's today, or order online at zaxbys.com.